astronauts that have been put into space, like on the International Space Station. When their eyes are dark adapted at night and they go to sleep, every couple of seconds they'll see a streak of light going across their closed eye. That's a particular cosmic ray that didn't have the attenuation of the atmosphere. It went roaring through the side of the International Space Station, went roaring through the vitreous humor and aqueous humor of their eye. Because it was moving faster than the speed of light in their eye, it gave off Cherenkov radiation. And the astronaut sees that as a streak of light in his eye. That happens every, I don't know if it happens every 3 seconds or every 30 seconds, but the astronauts, almost all of them will report, they see these streaks of light in the eye when they try to go to sleep. That gives you a hint of what's going on cosmic rays in space versus cosmic rays on the ground. You and I don't see that. It's that lack of us seeing that that leads me to believe that that atmosphere and that magnetic field is probably at least a 60 decibel attenuator. The only cosmic rays that get down to you and I are the ones that have been through the multiple bowling alleys, so to speak. Let me drop. Those cosmic rays hit some of the air molecules in the upper atmosphere like bowling pins. The bowling pins got rolling real fast because of that impact, and then the bowling pins hit other air molecules, and by the time that cascade comes down to you and me, it's probably been through the bowling pin process five times in a row before it gets to you, and a lot of attenuation and a lot of spreading out on each one of those impacts. So those cosmic rays almost never get directly to you and I. They got to get through too darn much stuff to get to you and me. That gives us a lot of protection. But by looking at all of those secondary events that occur on the surface of the Earth, comparing it to the measurements you make in a balloon or a rocket or in space, you can now measure some of the characteristics, some of the spectrum, figure out a little bit more about what's going on and what's really doing it. Some very violent events somewhere in space are doing that. And those cosmic rays, you study the direction of arrival. Let me drop. They come from every possible direction in space. There is no favored direction. That strongly indicates it's not coming, in the most part, it's not coming from this galaxy. Because if it was coming from this galaxy is like a pancake. 90-some-odd% of the energy is all in one flat plane of this galaxy, and there would be a huge increase of the cosmic rays parallel to the Milky Way, that plane, compared to all other directions. Those cosmic rays are coming from every possible direction. So somewhere out there at the perimeter, so to speak, of our observable universe, there's some violent events taking place. And that observable universe is 13 billion light years away in distance, which you could say took place 13 billion years ago. You're looking at events. Some of those cosmic rays represent an event that occurred 13 billion years ago, and at the speed of light, that stuff just got to you and me. It's a humbling thing to look at the whole big picture, what little we see of it, Wes. That's what little I know about cosmic rays. Enter XJN. Some of it's probably wrong. KQLIW.
The events that you mentioned took place in 1969 at the Apollo 11 mission, when the crew members reported seeing something like flashes of light in dark, even if they had a closed eyes. And later Apollo missions confirmed that phenomena. Now you ask, you said something about what happens when the cosmic rays hit the Earth. Well, as little as I know, it is the origin of the antimatter, where a highly energetic cosmic ray hits Earth. We would not detect it directly, but we would detect it something like the air shower or the cosmic ray, and the air shower are the cascade of the secondary particles created when the cosmic rays smash into the upper atmosphere. kilometers by the time they reach the ground. I have easier to operate in kilometers than in miles. Let me drop. The relatively low energy of cosmic ray from the sun, or say the solar wind, are responsible for the auroras. So, but you didn't get something that I was trying to point. When you have a hammer on the shelf, on the edge, and you just try to measure the amount of power that is needed to just slide that hammer, and that because of the gravity and the hammer will slash to the floor with a much greater force. Well, half a year ago, we were talking about what I've read from the scientific articles, how the scientists explain the avalanche in the spark gap. And they were saying that the cosmic ray comes and then the avalanche is created. That means that cosmic ray, if there is a 30 cosmic rays per second to our body, is accelerating the spark avalanche, the electron avalanche through the spark gap. Do you see the similarity to the European accelerator? And then we're talking about a speed. It's a bullet. It's an incredible 40 million times more energy per single particle. Also, very much criticized longitudinal waves. Think, we're dealing with the pieces of the matter, pieces of an atom flying through the space at incredible speeds. It's a matter. They go through the longitudinal direction. They don't wiggle into exia.
Wes, you speculated that the cosmic rays create the aurora borealis. I think they do not. The solar wind supplies millions of tons of particles from the sun, moving at 1 or 2 million miles an hour. They encounter the Earth's magnetic field. They become part of the Van Allen belt. They bounce back and forth between North Pole and South Pole, and some of those particles hit the atmosphere around the North Pole and the South Pole, and when they do, they make the atmosphere glow, and you and I call that aurora. I am guessing that 99% of the aurora is solar wind particles, not cosmic rays. The cosmic rays have got so darn much energy that they don't give a damn about following the magnetic field of our Van Allen belt. It takes much slower. I mean, a million miles an hour of particles from the solar wind. Let me drop. To you and me, sounds like a lot of speed. That is extremely slow. That's molasses slow compared to the velocity of a cosmic ray. They're not going to follow that Van Allen belt. And when the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 11 and others were outside of the Van Allen belt on the way to the moon, yeah, they saw much more of the Cherenkov radiation streaks in the eye. But the astronauts that are in the International Space Station, and they are under the Van Allen belt, they're getting partial protection from the Earth's magnetic field, but they're getting no protection from the Earth's atmosphere. They still see the Cherenkov streaks in the eye, just a slightly smaller number of them than the astronauts on the Apollo mission, which during translunar traveling, they were really outside the Earth's atmosphere, outside the Earth's magnetic field. They had no protection at all, and they saw a lot more of it. Now, if I take a completely black absorbing substance surface, let me drop. If I take a completely black absorbing surface and I aim it at the sun, I get 1,300 watts per square meter of energy continuously at high noon. If I use that exact same perfect absorbing surface and I absorb cosmic rays, the total amount of energy that I absorb on that perfectly absorbing surface is probably less than a nanowatt. I don't know what the number is, but it's many orders of magnitude lower than the photovoltaics or just a thermal absorber on the sun. So can we use cosmic rays as an energy absorbing device when the sun energy is giving us something that is millions of times greater? I don't think you can get very much practical energy out of cosmic rays with perfect absorption in 2XJN, K2RIW.
At first, when you look at Gerson's Zetin Cosmin limit, which is now by the name GZK limit, and then you go to the literature, which would be the Kolosov Oleg from 2007, ultra high energy cosmic rays, or you go to the Cosmic Rays International Seminar at September 15 of 2008, Nuclear Physics, then you're going to find that the auroras are dependable on the cosmic rays. Let me look. And there is a very much a close relationship between the lightnings and the auroras as well. Now, the spark is accelerated to the cosmic ray. At least this is a part of the knowledge of the official science. And I also mentioned about longitudinal wave, which you keep forgetting. This is a piece of matter, and that piece of matter is traveling at incredible speed and has the energy of 40 million times of the European accelerator. And to explain.
When you study what the sun is doing, when it does a CME, coronal mass expulsion, where you're getting these explosions that occur above a particular sunspot, and you wait a couple of days for that material to get to the Earth, and you then watch an aurora, there is a strong correlation between when you get an aurora borealis or an aurora australis, I think it's pronounced, when you get that and what you see on the sun with the SOHO satellite. SOHO can tell you where the last CME took place, where the material was aimed, is that material going to come to Earth? And with high probability, SOHO will tell you when and how strong you're going to get an aurora. So as I see it, the majority of that aurora is solar wind particles. Now, cosmic rays can come along and disturb that a little bit, and they can trigger certain things. I'm going to give you that. And when it comes to a high voltage between two probes where you and I are doing an arc experiment in air, let me drop. You can sometimes set a pair of probes at just the right distance, at just the right voltage, and you assume that air has a dielectric strength of 30,000 volts per centimeter. So you've got two probes that are nice and round, exactly 1 centimeter apart, and you put exactly 30,000 volts there. And you think you're going to break down the air. If you're right at the threshold, you may get an immediate breakdown. You may have to wait 50 seconds for a breakdown. When you're right at the threshold, you have to wait for a particular cosmic ray to come along and hit one of your air molecules, free up at least one electron, and that electron must travel fast enough, accelerate enough, caused by your induced voltage field in volts per meter. If it gets a chance to build up enough velocity before it strikes the next air molecule 63 nanometers away on average, if it acquires enough energy that when it strikes the next air molecule, it's able to ionize it and free another electron in the next air molecule, you've now got the beginning of an avalanche that you and I call an arc or a spark or a corona discharge or whatever. So, yes, the cosmic ray comes along, usually is the initializing event. If you could, by some magic, remove all cosmic rays from the environment, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find I could put 60,000 volts per centimeter instead of 30,000 volts per centimeter wave and not get a breakdown of the air. I think in most cases, it is a cosmic ray that when you're above the threshold of 30,000 volts per centimeter, is capable of initializing the event. But the cosmic ray itself...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What explanation for that?
I think the cosmic ray itself is only freeing up the electron that initializes the avalanche. It's not the cosmic ray giving the avalanche the energy to do its cascading. What's the word I'm looking for now? I can't think of the right word.
Cue ball, Dick.
Well, no, cue ball is close, but that's not it. When you get this, one breaks down two, which breaks down four, which breaks down six. There's a name for that event.
Chain reaction.
That's the right word. To initialize the chain reaction, a cosmic ray has to come along and free up at least one electron if you're above the threshold volts per meter for that particular air pressure of that particular gas. And each individual gas, let me drop. Okay, I wanted to make sure that we were getting through out east. Each individual gas has its own characteristic breakdown voltage in volts per meter. Sulfur hexafluoride, for instance, I think it's good for two or three times the volts per meter before you get a breakdown, sulfur hexafluoride, as opposed to ordinary air. Oxygen has one breakdown voltage, hydrogen another, nitrogen another. Sulfur hexafluoride is one of the highest. So each individual gas requires a different amount of energy of that free electron, which really means velocity. Once that electron has been freed, he's got to move through that 63 nanometers of space before he strikes the next molecule of that gas, and he's got to strike with enough velocity to do the next molecule of ionization, break off at least one electron in order to continue the avalanche. Otherwise, the whole thing dies.
Because your speculation is very much traditional, if you don't mind.
Okay, I want to leave the subject tonight and go on to the gun safety, because I think it's a much more important one.
Would that take only 2 minutes, or 3 minutes?
Not tonight. We're going to do that next week, Wes.
Could it take time for? You know, I have a simple explanation for it. I need 3 minutes, and I will not interrupt you.
This whole subject is not simple. If you were Einstein, I don't think you could make this one simple. I know that I can. I don't think anybody can. There's a lot more to this one than first meets the eye. I've been explaining it very simplistically up till now. You've been giving me more of the details. There's a hell of a lot more to it. I want to leave this subject for tonight, because there is no end to this one within the time that we've got. I think a much more important subject is the gun safety. John and I have had a number of discussions on this one, and I've got a radical-sounding proposal. When you hear my proposal, at first you're going to say, RIW has lost it on this one. Let me drop. However, if you hear the five or six concepts that are required as base material before you hear my proposal, then the proposal will make a little more sense. You have to admit ahead of time, there is no glamour fix for firearm safety in the United States. It's complicated. It's got a lot of politics, a lot of emotion, a lot of tradition. Our method of origin of this country is extremely different than a number of other countries. There are at least two countries on planet Earth that have rather successfully handled the problem of firearm safety. I just selected two individual countries, Australia and Switzerland. They both have very successfully handled firearm safety with two very different approaches. And can we copy their approach? There's a yes and a no. Strong yes on Switzerland, strong no on Australia. How did Australia come about? Let me drop. Back in the I don't know the exact year, 1500s, 1600s. There's a whole lot of criminals, so to speak, they had in the United Kingdom. They could have, if they wanted to, establish a whole bunch of prisons, put these people in prison, and feed them and clothe them and keep them warm and keep them incarcerated. And pretty soon you'd realize you got a whole lot of money and resources and space being spent on prisoners. The United States has chosen that approach. We have 2 million of our citizens in incarceration now. 2 million people. I don't know the exact number, but it probably requires $70,000 a year, and maybe more than that, to support each one of those 2 million people that are incarcerated. The United Kingdom had a much simpler approach. They got this great big chunk of land, 12,000 miles away, called Australia, which is under British rule. They just took all those prisoners and dropped them on Australia. Problem is solved. They're gone. Because of that method of creating the European population of Australia, Australia, when they had a gun problem, I don't know what year it was, I'm going to guess it was 20 years ago, they decided that, hey, these guns are causing a whole lot of homicides, let's get rid of the guns. The population voted for, if I understand correctly, the population voted for eliminating guns. They brought back the guns. They made the possession of guns illegal. If they did an inspection of your house and they found that you still had a gun, you got arrested. You were breaking the law. They got rid of the guns. Because of their method of origin, they could do that. Let me drop. We cannot do that. Cannot do that. Our citizens arrived from Europe because they were leaving what they thought was political oppression, religious oppression, freedom of speech oppression, because their main reason of leaving was to be pioneers in this new land and leave all of these oppressions. When they wrote the Constitution, the highest priority was freedom of speech. That's the First Amendment. The second highest priority is right to bear arms, to have guns. That was the Second Amendment. Damn high on our priority list. They had to have those guns so that they had a militia, so that the citizenry could protect themselves against a potential political oppression, to protect themselves against the animals as they proceed across this frontier land, and to protect themselves from what they thought was savages, the Native Americans. So, for a bunch of reasons, guns were extremely important, the second most important thing in our Constitution. With that as a background, and with all of your Supreme Court making sure that they obey constitutional law, let me drop it. With that Supreme Court making sure that they continue to honor the original intent of the founders of that Constitution, under those circumstances, no way in hell are you going to limit those guns. They're going to be there forever. You can do the best you want to try to make them illegal, to try to capture them all, to try to buy them all back. All you succeed in doing is of the ones that are left will become more valuable and become a higher value object on the black market. The guns are here to stay. You got to accept that. Yes, when it comes to new gun purchases, you can add some extra rules and regulations about background checks and whether or not the person is mentally stable and so on. You can somewhat limit the purchase of new weapons. 300 million weapons are here now. If you look at the DXCC list, I don't know the exact number, but there's something like 315 countries on the earth, according to the DXCC list that we recognize, 315 or 320 countries, something in that order. There's something very unique about one of those 315 countries. One of those countries has half of all the firearms on planet Earth. Half of all the firearms on this Earth are in one country, this one. You got to accept that. It's going to continue. Now you got to live with it. Let me drop. So therefore, you've got to find ways of making the guns that are here safer. There's the education. Now, where's that education going to come from? Here's the part that's most radical on my part. How do you fund it? Where does it come from? Let me give you a couple of stories first. It's going to sound crazy. If I'm in a parking lot, I'm trying to find a parking place, as I had to do recently, because of the Christmas shopping, it's very difficult to find a parking space. and I happen to see a guy, and I walk over to him as he's parking or leaving, and I strike up a conversation. The first thing that guy is going to do is assume that I'm a threat. Why the hell am I coming over to him and talking to him? What do I want? He's going to ask. Normal reaction. Call it xenophobia, if you like. But that's the way human beings are. When a complete stranger comes up to you and strikes up a conversation, your first impression is, what does he want? Why is he doing that? Okay. Let's assume that that guy I'm walking up to happens to have a mag mount antenna on his car, and he happens to have a coal letter license plate. And my car has a mag mount antenna and a coal letter license plate. And as I'm driving my car and parking it alongside of his, I send a CQ on the horn. Or I get out of the car and I whistle a CQ. Or I go over to him and I say a couple of words in hand lingo. Immediately, I've got a friend. We are a member of the same fraternity. One human being per 500 in the general population of the United States is a ham radio operator. We're way beyond a minority. I mean, there are groups of people in the United States that represent 5% of the population, and we call them a minority. 0.2% of the population of this country are ham radio operators. They're a minority among minorities. We're a subculture among subcultures. But boy, are we a fraternity. You run into a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You run into a fellow ham radio operator. And it's like you and he are both a member of a secret fraternity in your particular college. Automatically, he's a friend, with rare exception. What do we hams do? Boy, do we talk to each other. If one of us discovers a brand new antenna, if one of us discovers a Waxon radio, we get a whole lot of bang for the dollar. Boy, we go and tell everybody. We talk to each other. We spread the word, no matter what the hell the word is. If the word is good, we spread it. If the word is bad, we spread it. If the word exists, we spread it. We talk. Okay, let me drop. There's a not quite as tight society, a subculture, of gun owners. Among the gun owners, there are the guys who like rifles, and maybe there are assault rifles. There are guys who like shotguns. There are guys who like handguns. There are guys who like shotguns. There are guys who like hunting rifles. There are guys who like Glocks. There are all kinds of various kinds of weapons. Oh, by the way, among the ham radio operators, you've got a subgroup of the VHF guys and the HF guys. And they're a little bit tighter. The VHF guy talking to another VHF guy is a little bit tighter than the guy that's HF talking to a VHF. But still, it's part of the same fraternity. So among the gun owners, they talk to each other. They meet at shooting ranges. They meet on the hunting ground. They talk to each other. When it comes to gun knowledge, they talk. So, if by some means you can create an incentive by which the general population of gun owners will be willing to go to a class, and if that class is offered free of charge, and maybe we even give an incentive. If I take a defensive driving course, I've got a real incentive to do that. I got two incentives. Let me drop. My first incentive for doing that is I want to stay alive on the road. I drive every day to work, there and back, and I want to stay alive. The defensive driving course helps me do that. That's one of my motivations. I've also got an economic motivation. My automobile insurance company will give me a 10% discount on the premiums if I, every 3 years, take a driver education course. That's incentive. If you offer the gun safety course, the firearm safety course, free of charge with an incentive, and what's the incentive going to be? Maybe you can create an incentive where the homeowner insurance gets cheaper, the automobile insurance gets cheaper, the tax gets cheaper, the property tax, the state income tax, the federal income tax. There's got to be some kind of an economic advantage for the person who takes the free course. So you can give the guy free course. And I'll admit ahead of time, at best, maybe 10% of the population is going to take the course and take the incentive. But they talk to each other. Another 20 or 30% of the gun-owning population is going to hear about the course, and left-handedly, they're going to hear the advantages of taking the course, or at least they're going to hear the good information about what the course creates in gun safety. Let me drop. So if you can establish the course, and if you can create the incentive where gun owners will take the course, you get a benefit. percentage of the population does it. 12,400 people die per year in the United States from gunshot wounds. I'm guessing close to 100,000 people a year get a gunshot wound. 12,400 die on the average year. That's 34 people dying every single day. If by way of the course, you can change that by one-third, the benefit of the course where people learn firearm safety and obey those rules for firearm safety, only one-third of the population obeys the rules. That's 4,000 lives. One-third of 12,400 people is roughly 4,000 people. At first, that doesn't sound like much. Put it in context of warfare. If you could have created some kind of a change in the way we conducted the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, let me drop it. If you could have given them better training, better hardware, more troops, if you could have done something with either of those wars and saved 4,000 soldiers' lives, boy, we'd be jumping up and down with success. Wow. I don't think we've lost anywhere near that number of lives in the whole darn 10 years of those two or three wars. 4,000 lives per year can potentially be saved if only one-third of the people follow the rules that we're talking about. There is no 100% way of solving the problem. You have to settle, and you can't even get the 90% solution. If you get the one-third solution, you've done a lot. 4,000 lives per year, I think, can potentially be saved. Okay, you see the potential benefit of the course. You see a way that you can create the incentive by which some people will take the course. Only a small percentage are going to take it, but the word will get passed in the process. Knowledge gets passed. Good knowledge, it propagates automatically. Just like the Waxon radio guarantees a good knowledge about how to save lives with gun safety is going to be propagated. Okay, where's the funding going to come from? Here's where I get a little bit weird. Let me drop it. I visited a number of my friends, some of them hams, some of them non-hams, in Long Beach, Long Island, Far Rockaway. I didn't even get a chance to get as far as Breezy Point. But I saw something extremely interesting. First of all, I saw a war zone. Damage and devastation, and great big dumpsters out in front of people's houses. 3 and 4 weeks later, still tremendous numbers of these 30 cubic yard dumpsters in front of people's houses being rented at $60, or is it, I think it's $300, I don't know what the price is. It's a fairly big price. Being filled up with people's private possessions, sofas and chairs and tables, and sheetrock and 2x4s and whatever, taking their houses apart, filling them up with this stuff that has to be replaced. And a hell of a lot of construction going on. Where was all that construction coming from? A big faction of it was FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Association. Once an area gets declared a disaster zone, FEMA comes along, and in many of those people immediately gave them a $2,000 check. After an inspection of the house took place, if the damage was big enough, in many cases they got a $31,500 check. At first, some very narrow-minded, sometimes Republican people can say, hey, that's an entitlement. We're wasting money here. We've got to cut that back. That is not an entitlement. That is not a waste of money. That's a huge investment, a beautiful investment. Let me show you why. If you didn't do that, a certain percentage of those people would abandon the area forever. The house, for two reasons, is underwater. Number one, the value of the house is now less than the value of the mortgage. A certain percentage of people will walk away from that. And literally, some of those houses were really physically underwater. If people walk away from the house, you end up with a blighted neighborhood. You end up with an abandoned house that slowly decays. The property values in the neighborhood go down. Everything looks ugly. Because the local community loses the tax base of that particular house, your community gets less money. Your county gets less money. Your state gets less money. The people have moved away. In some cases, they move out of the state. If you don't give them financing and they abandon the house, all kinds of economic disadvantage takes place. FEMA gives you a grant, free money, so to speak. In some cases, it's a low-interest loan, but most cases, splendid money. It's a beautiful investment. You wait 5 or 10 years because of the difference in what happens to that community and the cash flow and the enthusiasm of that community, and communities that went down the tube and they don't become a ghost town. And those abandoned houses, if you abandon the house and the house goes on it becomes a mortgage foreclosure and nobody will possess it because it's done too darn much damage, it eventually becomes this ugly thing that becomes a shooting gallery. And you get derelict people living there and whatever, all kinds of disadvantages. FEMA comes along and finances these people and all kinds of good things happen. They get confidence in their life and they suddenly realize that it really is government of the people, by the people, and for the people. In that particular case, that particular government, that arm of the government called FEMA, is working for you. It's making an investment in you, your house, and your community, because in the total dollar flow, you could say that that town, that county, that government eventually gets it back. But
repeater, time out, cancel.
From my point of view, that FEMA money is an investment, and you get that investment back many times fold. Very similar to what happens when you invest money in NASA. NASA builds some very fancy space hardware that goes out there, and if you want to be a pessimist, you can say all we got out of the Apollo program is we brought home a few hundred pounds of lunar soil. We put a hell of a lot of people to work. We developed a hell of a lot of exotic hardware, ceramics for space combs and computers for navigating and rockets for putting satellites in space. We got a hell of a lot of fallout, positive fallback. For every dollar you put into NASA, you got $6 or $10 or $20 back in benefit. It was an investment, not a waste. Same thing with FEMA. It's an investment. Okay? So all FEMA has to do, all FEMA has to be entitled to give you this money, is there has to be a declaration of this is a disaster area. Hurricane Sandy came along on this particular chunk of land. She created disaster, and along comes FEMA that, with some testing, gives you money. And the money does good things. Okay? As I see it, what's happening with firearms is a disaster. We have to declare firearms as a disaster area. Once you do that, FEMA can make an investment to put some money into financing the teachers, financing the schools. I mean, it's going to be a night course, as I see it, where that night course in your local high school will teach you firearm safety. And you can volunteer for it, and you're going to get the incentive of the knowledge of the course, meeting your fellow gun owners, and getting what other incentive we can create, whether it's a decrease in your taxes or your insurance policy premiums, whatever. And only a small percentage are going to do it, but that's all it takes, because they talk to each other, and the word...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
There's one other thing we got to look at here. We got to think globally. We are shocked to the core that 20 very innocent 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds, or was it 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds, got gunned down mercilessly. However, you got to think globally. And here, people are going to get mad at me. I understand this. As bad as that is, I don't think 100 students per year die of gunshot wounds in schools from massive shootings like that. I don't think 100 students die. Maybe it is. Maybe it's a little bit more than that. 12,400 Americans die per year from gunshot wounds. So it's not just the schools you have to protect. There's a hell of a lot more carnage going on of real human beings beyond children. Putting a guard, an armed guard in each school is not going to do it. Columbine had a great big massacre, and there was an armed guard in that school. A person that's about to do a massacre in a school, let me drop. A person that's dialing a massacre in school is doing something that is premeditated. He thinks about it for weeks or months ahead of time. He plans on what weapon, what time, who's going to be there, how many bullets he's got, how many magazines he's got, what clothing he's going to wear. The guy who did this work in Newtown was wearing Kevlar clothing. He was partially protected. That armed guard in the school, in the process of him doing the premeditated preparation for the event, even if he knows that God is there, it is a partial deterrent. Maybe it's going to cut down by 2 to 1 the number of shootings in that particular school. It's still going to take place. Columbine is a good example. The guy knows the first thing he's going to have to do when he enters the school is to shoot the guard. Is the guard going to wear a bulletproof vest 24 hours every day of his employment? And even if he's wearing a bulletproof vest that only protects his torso, what protects his legs? What protects his head? Is he going to wear protective bulletproof thing over his head and do that for 8 hours of every day? It isn't realistic. The perpetrator will just decide he's going to shoot the guard in the head. And he can do it from a long enough distance with a sniper scope on the rifle, if you know what I mean. So that's not going to stop enough. It's a partial deterrent, but that's not it. It's going to take the education for firearm safety that removes the incentive to do that, whether it be psychological, whether it be the availability of the weapons, the availability of the shells, the bullets. The education is going to give us the biggest bang for the dollar. I see the possibility of cutting down 3 to 1/3 of the potential deaths in the United States. 12,400 divided by 3 is roughly 4,000 people. It's a much bigger number than the 100 that happened in school. The 100 that happened in school are the ones that really grab us by the throat, so to speak. That's the ones that horrified us enough to really consider this. But it's not the big picture. That's some of my thinking on this. Of course, some of this is crazy. Some of it has got holes in it. It's got to be refined. But it's a way of approaching the problem, I am guessing. I'm going to pass it over to John first because John, from 6 years of age, was trained with firearms.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And John, you can, therefore, you with your experience with firearms can make some suggestions as to how wrong I am, how right I am, what we should change, and so on. KC2WGB. Take your time, John. K2RIW in the tech net.
KC2KHR coming.
KHR recognized, but John first.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, you're 100% right in everything you said. You have to think about something. Now you talk about a guard in school. Well, banks have guards. You still get the maniacs that go in there, either with a note or with a weapon. It still happens. Okay, you're right. He's not going to have a helmet on. He's not going to look like a Marine. He's going to maybe have a bulletproof jacket on. Okay. There's things called devastators. Okay. Those are exploding rounds. They'll do a lot of damage. There's also Teflon. Those bullets go right through those vests. There is really no answer other than education. The loonies are still going to be out there, and we have to prevent them from getting guns somehow. And if they're known loonies, and they're in a home with guns, well, those guns have to be locked up, or that person has to be locked up. The risk factor has to be assessed, and that's where we fail. But there's a lot of things that now, when you talk about gun legislation, okay, the idea of the weapon originally, according to the Second Amendment, was for the public defense by the militia. Let me let it drop for a second. So why should the militia, which is supposed to be protecting their community, going to be relegated to, say, single-round ammunition or three-shot ammunition when the threat may have 30-clip weapons or 100-round weapons? So you have a balance there, too. There's so many things. We need gun owners and the politicians, the lawmakers, and good, bright people to make decisions on managing gun distribution from this point on in America. You know, if you have violence, if you've ever been committed or arrested for a violent crime, you should not have a weapon at all, especially any physical injury, because you are a violent person. We can't trust you with a weapon. Those are all common sense things, and I think exactly what you're saying, those things should be followed up. A lot of merit in what you said, Dick. Pick it up, Dick, and pick up to the new station, JHR. I think it's Joel.
Yeah, each of the suggested improvements up till now are very partial. They all make controlling the sale of new weapons and who can get them and the background check. That's going to control the newly purchased weapons, but that's only 1 or 2 or 3% of the weapons we're going to have a year from now. There's 300 million weapons in private hands in the United States now. We have to address those. And so each of these suggestions, we're looking for the glamour fix. It doesn't exist. We hope we can find a 90% fix. It doesn't exist. We're going to find a number of 3% fixes, and maybe, if I was really optimistic, maybe what I'm suggesting is a 30% fix. But 30% of 12,000 people is 4,000 people. It's worth a try. Joel, I believe that you've worked or have worked or are working with law enforcement, probably in New York City. Guarantee you've got some opinions as to what we should do, what we can do. K2JHR, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yes, good evening, Dick. I am a law enforcement officer, and I work out of Westchester County. I'll put it to you this simply. Think of the Murrah building. This individual wanted to take down a federal wall. He wanted to take down a federal building. Didn't use any firearms. Simply used fertilizer, used whatever materials he could put together, made a bomb out of it. It's been done in the past by others. Unfortunately, there are many firearms out there, and no matter what we're going to do, yes, education is very important, but if you have an individual that definitely wants to make certain that they want to hurt someone, they're going to find a way to do it. If it's not a firearm, it's going to be a motor vehicle. If it's not a motor vehicle, it's going to be gasoline. If it's not gasoline, it's going to be something. But if they have it in their mind to do it, and I've been at this for over 30 years, if they have it in their mind to do it, they're going to do it. They'll find a way. Controlling firearms is one way, but not the only way.
I agree with that. However, you take a Bushmaster AR-15 assault weapon with a clip of 10, 30, or 100 shells on board, he can mow down people at a rate that you can't come close. You can't come close to that rate with knives, gasoline, bombs, whatever. Well, with one exception, yeah, with a whole lot of preparation. That guy in Oklahoma City, he did kill 153 people in one big bang, but it took a lot of preparation, a lot of practice in a field in Michigan and whatever to do that. So when it comes to the rate of killing and the distance of the killing and the dynamics of the killing, the assault weapon, assault rifle, is way at the top of the list. And therefore, I'd like to address it first, knowing that it's far from the whole solution. A really mad guy with a knife can kill a lot of people. He can't kill them as fast, and he can't do it at such a distance. Without assault weapon, in theory, you give me 30 seconds and I can kill everybody within 100 feet, maybe within 200 feet. And particularly if I start going to the automatic mode, my goodness, can I create carnage. You can't do that with a gun, a knife, or all these other techniques. So I think we got to approach guns first. But that's an opinion, Joel. K2JHR, K2LIW.
Opinion, Dick, when you get a chance.
C2OIS.
John and OIS recognize, but Joel first. Go ahead, Joel.
Hi, Dick, I agree with you. Education is everything. Obviously, in this scenario in Newtown, Connecticut, the mother had the weapons, the son learned how to use the weapons, and did so. I'll just send it over to the first station. I think it's K2OYS. Take it.
No, it's John first. KC2WGB. Go ahead, John.
2MB with a comment, too.
Okay, Dick, remember now, you're talking about the amount of people killed here in a year. Most of those people are not killed with automatic weapons. Most of those people are not killed with, like, AR-15s and those things. They're usually either single-shot revolvers or semi-automatic weapons. There's a little thing there. You know, it's just that the romance or the horror of the AK-47 or the M-16 is prevalent right now. But that's not where most people get killed. Just a note. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
I agree with that. But still, firearms as a weapon can kill faster, with a longer distance, at a higher rate than almost any of these other weapons. So firearms, as I see it, have to be the top of our list of priorities of where we apply the education. Yeah, we also have to stop cutting back all of the funding when it comes to mental illness. And we've been cutting back that funding and we're paying the price. We have to accept the fact that mental illness does exist, and that has to also be properly financed. OIS, give us your full call letters and your name, and then your comments, sir, and after that it's going to be moon bounce. OIS, go right ahead.
I think it's Mark, KC2OIS, from Queens. Yeah, listen, I want to, first of all, an AR-15 is not an assault weapon. An assault weapon, a weapon doesn't assault anybody, that's to begin with. But you have to look up what the definition of an assault weapon is. And it is not a full automatic, and 99% of the states do not allow full automatic weapons. Let me get over to the Murrah building. You brought up the Murrah building. The Murrah building was blown out, not in. That's a fact. And they knew there were bombs there, and the BATF was suiting up outside prior to. Let me let it drop. And as far as most of these cases are because these people are on psychotropic drugs. Every one of these instances, there's somebody that's on a psychotropic drug. Psychotropic drugs cause people to do these things. They cause suicide. They have all the children on Ritalin, and half the adults are on some kind of similar drug. And this is where the problem is. As far as the governor is concerned and the mayor is concerned and whoever else is concerned about this, including the president, which is going to do this under fiat, they are usurping the Constitution. I will tell you now that nobody is going to listen, and there will be war. Over to you, Dick.
Barry, if you have a way of getting over to 975...
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
He's got to do is shoot that guard. I'm a little bit afraid he would have thought that way. and 2MB, K2RAW.
Barry, there was a armed guard at Columbine. Do you have any idea what happened and why that armed guard wasn't able to limit the carnage there? N2MB, K2RAW, and then send it over to Jim. You got it, Barry. KC2WGB, K2RAW. Also, I'm a little curious as to why when I go through the 975-375 machine, I'm coming out at 8.5 and Barry does not. I'm curious as to what's going on there. KC2WGB, K2RAW. You got it, John.
On 2.5 because I can hear him on the input of the 8.5 old machine. He's not going to the 3.75. Barry, is that correct?
I'm on the
82 AOC comment.
John, you want to make a comment first, then we're going to pick up AOC after that. Go ahead, John. K2WGB, K2RAW. Give me another transmission. I had the antenna in the wrong direction, John. I think I'm copying a lot better now, so go ahead.